As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
The Phil Hayes Show.
Hello and welcome to the show, brought to you by The Athletic with The Square Ball. Dan here from The Square Ball, along with Michael and Phil Hayes, straight from Jesse Marsh's press conference. From The Athletic as well. Twice a week, this show, Mondays and Fridays. Friday edition, this one is where Phil Hotfoot sit from the press conference at Thorpe Arch. Straight into the studio, and we reflect on what Jesse's been saying. And then Monday, we react to the game. So Monday, we'll be back to look back on the Arsenal game this weekend. We will be previewing it in due course. Shows are all free, by the way. You can listen ad-free when you subscribe to The Athletic. You can get the ad-free pods, all Phil's writing about Leeds, joining with the match day discussions, all that sort of thing. At theathletic.com/Leeds pod. Pound a month. For 6 months at the minute, theathletic.com/Leeds pod. Into the post-presser chat then, Phil.
Liz Truss or Jesse Marsh?
Liz Truss, the Chancellor. Kwarteng has now gone. It's now Jeremy Hunt, who's back in. Kwarteng lasted less time than... outlasted Milanich, but less time than Brian Clough and Jock Stein.
It is like the Chileno era in politics, isn't it? I was telling Adam Hurry, who does a Football Clichés podcast, that football Twitter speak seems to be flowing into politics and other things. I saw somebody reply to a tweet about the economy saying sterling is a Finnish currency. And I also saw somebody replying to a tweet about Liz Truss saying something like Keir Starmer is clear. And I was thinking it's only a matter of time before they start calling Liz Truss Pris Pros. And maybe this is the week.
I don't understand half of what it means, but it sounds entertaining. What was your big takeaway then from speaking to Jesse? Because you lit the blue touch paper under him a little bit today, didn't you? You got a little bit narky about the question about plan B for anybody who's not aware of what this is. You said to him, you know, this team's set up to play in a particular way. I'm paraphrasing now. Why don't you repeat the question?
No, that's pretty much what I said. You know, system team's been built to fit a system. Are they built to play a different system? How adaptable are they, and how much do you teach adaptability? I thought he answered the question well, actually. He was talking about shades of grey and saying that when it comes to tweaking a plan or changing a plan or whatever else, it isn't necessarily a leap from one set system to another set system, that you can almost do it incrementally through change players off the bench, through systems, formations, all that sort of thing that can, I guess, tweak a team subtly rather than majorly. But I do think on the basis of what we've seen this season, there is the question of how suited the players are to playing out with this style, which relies so much on pressing, counter-pressing, turnover ball, transitional play, when it works. And we saw it work really well against Chelsea. And I thought it worked pretty well in the first half against Palace. He said he actually thought that was the best performance they've had under him, or best 45 minutes they've had under him at Palace. I'm not so sure it was as good as Chelsea, but I kind of take his point there. It seemed to me on Sunday that when it came to actually reasserting themselves in a game that had changed and was different to how it had been initially when Leeds were dominating, it was difficult. It was difficult to rein it back in.
Is that why you asked the question then?
Yeah, very much so.
To see what he thought of the inability of the team to get back into it. Is that what you're trying to get at?
And also because the signings that have been made in the summer, the specific roles and positions that they've been signed for feed into this system that he wants to play. And the tactical format that he's come up with, tactical plan that he has. And the question has to be asked, I think, you know, when your form isn't great, when the performances have been a bit mixed, is there a way out? You know, is there a way in games where you find yourself compromised or you find yourself struggling slightly to change it? How do you change it? What are his ideas for changing it. He said that they go through every week from plan A to plan Z, as he put it. And, you know, it did touch on himself and the idea of plan B, which gets discussed a lot and did get discussed with his predecessor as well. I think the difference for his predecessor was that plan B came up in the periods when it wasn't going great. And prior to his final season, it was very rarely not going great. You know, it did tend to be very good more often than not. It's been far more mixed under Marsh. And I think as time goes on, everybody's just waiting to see, is this going to settle into consistent form and, I guess, a steady league position further on in the season?
Within this range of plans then that he says exist, where, I suppose it's a legitimate question to ask, where they were against Southampton and Palace, games that for a long period we looked in charge of and like we were heading for an easy win, and then we were unable to turn the tide when they got on top.
I think he accepts that at Southampton the substitutions should have come earlier, and he referenced that today, the fact that at 2-0 up you could feel the tide turning slightly. And there was a delay in sending anyone on from the bench. There was a call, I think, particularly for Cleek at some point before Southampton scored the first goal. And once the first goal went in, the impetus shifted completely, as it quite often does. And, you know, the price of that was 2 points dropped. Palace, to my mind, felt slightly different. There were a lot of changes at Palace. There were substitutions off the bench. There were alterations to the system. But it didn't really seem to translate into, you know, suddenly a far more creative performance. Didn't, I think, translate into a performance that looked like it was going to win the game from 1-0 as opposed to lose it. That would be my point.
Is it more about the efficacy of plan B, C, D, whatever it might be, rather than him actually having one? I think do we accept that they have multiple tactical plans because their coaches were not, obviously? So you think, right, okay, yeah, fair enough. Accept that. But does it work?
Well, I think you have to. And I think in any game, when you're managing in-game, you're going to do things that are based on the way that the game goes. You're going to have variables like players getting sent off, for example, like they had against Aston Villa, players having a poor day where normally they're pretty consistent or tend to play well. And that's when you have to kind of adapt on your feet. I think there have been games where Marsh has managed them far better than others. I think the Chelsea game, for example, it wasn't done and dusted that at 2-0 by any means. And I think that was handled in a way that kept Leeds on top, kept them in a position to win it, and I guess kept the foot on Chelsea's neck. Less so away at Southampton, certainly less so last weekend at Palace. It was difficult at Palace, I felt, from half an hour onwards. I think I said on Twitter that it seemed to me to have been a little bit of a slow slide from really dominant opening, and an opening that you felt had set Leeds up to win on the day, to a position later in the second half where it did feel as if there was going to be a third goal in the game, it was going to come from Palace, and it did.
Do you think this sort of loss of control aspect that we sometimes see in football, you know, just it happens like that, doesn't it? You can't control all games from start to finish because there are two teams who are playing. But this loss of control that we saw against the likes of Southampton and Palace, do you think that kind of contributes to the question and answer about Crescenzio Somerville when he said today, I need to find a way to get him more minutes? And we were sort of joking facetiously here in the office just before that, was like, well, put him on earlier then. or, you know, playing from the start, that's how you're giving more minutes. But it's about the shape of games, isn't it? And when is the right moment to introduce him? Do you think that loss of control or lack of control in games recently has contributed to him not getting as many minutes as he might want to give him?
It does make a difference, without a doubt. I think there is, in that that attacking line behind the number nine, there is definitely a pecking order. And I think at the moment, my guess would be in Marsh's head that Sinisterra, Harrison and Aronson making up the three is his preferred choice. We saw against Villa that Harrison and Sinisterra played on the opposite side of the pitch to what you'd normally expect, Harrison in particular out on the right. But I think that's what he'd go for when everybody's fit and available. And if you have somebody like Sinisterra playing very well, then the opportunities for Somerville become more limited. If you have somebody like Harrison, who, as we're going to talk about in part three, is so heavily involved in the attacking play at Leeds, almost to excess. You know, there's a huge amount that is going through Harrison. Again, he becomes pretty fundamental to the system and fundamental to the success of it. That's when it is a challenge to squeeze through 21s and to get them into the side. There's also the judgment, I suppose, about how effective the 21s are likely to be and how good they're going to be. I mean, Somerville, to my mind, has looked in a lot of 21s games, and people say this about him in training as well, like he's deserved to have minutes in the first team. But I can't say he's really shone in the first team yet. And I don't know whether you can really say that's down to him, but he hasn't had a particularly big effect. And I guess we all watch a lot more of the 21s these days because it's far more accessible. It's available usually on Twitter. It's usually free to watch. Most of it is televised. And I think that probably heightens the temptation to look at every 21 who is having a good spell in that league and at that level and to think, well, you know, it's time to give them a chance, time to push them through. But you still have to be pretty, you know, carefully judgmental about it. And you still have to take a kind of honest and professional view about who's actually ready for it. The one thing I'd say about Somerville is that they have let Dan James go, and Somerville is very much in the picture. So when it comes to players who should be used to change a game or are there to be used, then he has to be one of them, and he has to figure.
I think part of the frustration around Somerville was against Palace, it seemed like a perfect opportunity to actually give him a go, because we've seen Rodrigo play at 10 absolutely loads of times. As to my mind, it's never worked or has worked maybe once or twice. So to not have him playing in that, it's not like you had to leave anyone out to put him in. It was just an opportunity to give him a bit of a free hit, it felt like. And once again, we saw that Rodrigo was not particularly suited to it.
And he did say before the Palace game, he intimated, I thought, that those were the two options in his head, that it was either Somerville on the right with Aronson in the middle, or it was going to be Aronson moving out to the right so that Rodrigo could play in the middle and Bamford could play up front. I agree with you about Rodrigo. And what I found quite revealing when we dug into the attacking stats this week was just how much, again, a little bit like Harrison, how much has gone through Rodrigo, how much of the attacking play he's seen, how many chances he's seen, the goals he's scored in comparison to just about everybody else in the team, especially Bamford. I'm still not convinced that Rodrigo fits at Leeds. It fits the intensity of the football that both Bielsa and Marsh want to play. But I can't help feeling, part of me feels that because there's been this struggle to get Bamford up to 100%. And Marsh said today that Bamford had had today, talking about Friday, had had today off because, again, they were just trying to keep him in shape. They were just trying to keep him fit, keep him, I guess, following the sort of trajectory that they want him to have. And ultimately, I would guess, to not push him too hard. It makes me think more and more about whether actually the player they should be lumping on up front is Rodrigo at 9. I didn't think I'd be saying that this season because I still think Bamford's direct running, his style of play as a centre forward, I still feel it fits this team far better than Rodrigo does. But who's been scoring the goals and who's been getting on the end of the chances and who's looked a bit more like taking them? I think it's something that has to be thought about.
Well, if you heard the Q&A the other week, Phil, it was suggested that we do a Buckfast drinking game. Every time you drop the B-bomb, the Bielsa bomb, you are to have a shot. Or you could have something non-alcoholic as well. We don't want to promote too much binge drinking, do we?
You have, needless to say, got some energy drinks, which look like they've come through a sort of commercial sponsorship deal stacked behind us. I won't say what they are because I probably shouldn't. But it looks very tempting.
I was just going to say though, you did
apple flavored.
You did drop the B bomb in there, so that's
one shot
number one.
Shall we top them up and just drink them all on New Year's Eve?
And that, again, we're trying to dissuade people from this. I'm not sure this is necessarily the route down which we want to go.
Mind you, you could do
an athletic long read on the monks of the Buckfast Abbey.
Why not?
Injuries, we had an update. We'll come back to the attacking stuff actually in part three because we want to talk about it in a little bit more depth. The injuries update. Yelda had his appendix out, so he's out for a week, but he's back on the pitch. Forshaw surgery went okay. Archie Gray's on the pitch, but not available. Harvey Sutcliffe torn ACL, which is the second time he's done it, which is a shame.
He's only
a very young man. Dallas, hopefully part of the group in December, and everyone else is okay, including Junior Firpo. So pull on any of those threads that you want.
Yeah, it was made to sound as if Dallas will certainly go with them to do what they do when the World Cup break is on. And as I've said before, the plan, if everything falls into place, would be to head to the States for a short period of time. Of more interest than that, I think, was probably that Firpo is fit but won't start on Sunday. That question was asked specifically, you know, will he play ahead of Strike, given that he is a left-back, Strike kind of isn't? To which Marsh said, Strike is playing at a high level and will stay there. You know, he said he will start against Arsenal. I don't think I can disagree with that, to be honest. I think he's doing okay as Strike. And even though I've said previously that you feel with Firpo that if he's ever going to find a rhythm and a flow at Leeds, he needs to get into the team. It doesn't feel like the stage at which you want to be disrupting that. I think when you're a little bit out of form or you're needing results, and I suppose to be fair, Marsh made this point, it feels like a long time since the last league win, and it is a long time since the last league win, but that's because they've hardly played any games this season and there's been this massive break in the middle of it already. But it is the Chelsea game when last had a win. And he said, you know, we're desperate to get this going again. And I think when you're starting to feel the need to get a win on the board, the last thing you want to start doing is to mess around with positions where things look relatively steady.
How long until we consider Strouk a left back and someone who can provide genuine cover there? Because it's felt like since the start of the season we've been saying
August, Michael.
He's playing really well, considering he's a centre back. But the more he plays, the better he seems to get at it. So do you reach a point where you go, well, actually, he can kind of do it now?
Well, that's what they're doing, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but was that part of the plan, or did they just occurred?
That stands to reason, doesn't
strikes
it?
Strikes me as on they are, yeah.
On a totally amateur level, it's like turning up at a kickboxing class as a fat 41-year-old.
And you were just—that was a very specific example, Phil. Would you care to enlighten us?
Yeah, and then seeing
Scottish,
yes, yeah, very much so, and bald, and then seeing where you are in a year's time, which is pretty much where I am with it, and actually realizing that without being Bruce Lee or Liam Harrison, you'd get better. You know, you are improving. You get a bit more flexible. You're starting to get to grips with it more. So if Strike has a long run of games at left back, he certainly looks like he can be competent there. I don't think his body shape is ever going to properly lend itself to being a modern wing back. But then, interestingly, we're writing about Cody Gakpo for next week.
Hakpo.
Yes, need to write that on the back of my hand. So that you know, before the Europa League game that's coming up between Arsenal and PSV Eindhoven, and every time you speak to anybody about Hakpo, they always say, his body shape is really intriguing because he is 6'2", 6'3". He's the sort of size that would not make you think automatically looking at him as he's a winger. But he just has this natural agility and natural ability to play despite his height, you know, to play as a winger, to be really quick, to be great 1v1 and everything else. So it's not to say that Strike can't cope there. And I have to say, if Strike settles in longer term and is fine or better than fine, there isn't going to be a lot of clamour to replace him, is there?
Bit like Ben White, isn't it, for Arsenal?
I was going to say, and you look at the other fullback, Tommy Asu's playing there for Arsenal. Both of those are over 6 foot, aren't they? So, and it does happen. And Dan Burn is freakishly tall.
Well, that's it. And one of the things with Ben White is that technically he's very good. You know, he's good on the ball and he can cope with the ball coming to him a lot. And when you're out wide, you're receiving the ball and usually in tighter areas than you are at centre back. You've got to be quicker on it. You've got to be sharper with it. And I think somebody like White can cope with that. But I don't think I particularly look at White and think there's a wing back in the making. I think, you know, he's long term, he's going to be very good in the middle of defence, isn't he?
It doesn't bode well, particularly, that our best left back is currently someone we didn't know was a left back a few months ago.
But it was the risk, wasn't it? It was the risk going into this season without signing one that might happen. And also, Helder, who has played at left back, looks like he can play at left back. Again, you're talking about a more of a central defender moving across there, but somebody who might have been an alternative has, you know, had injuries now, obviously the appendix as well, appendix out, meaning that he's missed games. But no,
he's lost some weight though, if he's shed the appendix.
Well, yeah, so all good. I had mine out when I was 12, didn't shed any weight, just kept me in Edinburgh Infirmary for 4 nights. That was it, and got a few days off school, which is quite good. But yeah, it was part. There were two things in the summer, weren't there? There was a centre forward. Do we need a centre forward? Do we need another left back?
Yes to both.
And because there wasn't a left back coming in, it meant that it was going to be Firpo. And if it wasn't Firpo, once Leif Davis left to Ipswich, it was going to be somebody adapting to fit there. So Harrison or Helder, or as it is, Strike. You know, Strike is a left footer, so it can be done. But he's not somebody who has been a left back from the year dot.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Happy birthday, Leeds United. Leeds United, 103 years old on Monday.
Seems like 2 minutes since the centenary, in a lot of respects.
It's been a pandemic in the middle. It's sort of made time all stand still or speed up or weird stuff's gone on.
Yeah, because we spoke to Rob over on one of our shows, Rob, one of our writers and podcasters, and he went over to Castellón to see Pablo. And he pointed out the last time he'd seen Pablo play in the flesh was against Huddersfield. I was like, yeah. Oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah. It is that long ago. I mean, I love the centenary because it drove you towards finding out about, far more about, I think, the club's history and bits of history, corners of it that you hadn't looked into before. We did a long piece which kind of looked at all the different eras of Leeds United. So as we got closer to the modern day, it went through the decades. But prior to that, you know, did a piece pre-war which looked at Tom Jennings, prolific striker they had back before the Second World War. And then after that, piece on John Charles, post-war era, I went to meet his son who was running a pub out towards Selby Way. Lovely guy and great stories. I mean, it was quite sad with Tom Jennings. In the end, he lived up towards Glasgow. And I went up there to dig around a little bit. I'd hoped to ask the people at the house where he lived when he died if they had any idea that they owned or rented a house owned by somebody who was such a good footballer in his time. I suspect the answer was absolutely not. And did a little bit of digging around as well to try and find out where he was buried. And there didn't seem to be any reference to it at all, certainly not in the local area. I mean, he must be buried somewhere. But asked various councils and there just was nothing at all. And quite intriguing. I spoke to Eddie Gray about him and, you know, Eddie was saying, Tom Jennings is probably the sort of guy that you look at and say, well, it was different era back then, the rules were different, you know, it was like this, that and the other. But you don't score that many goals without being an absolutely terrific player. And he said, you know, he's one of the guys who you'd love to know a bit more about, we'd love to actually have any chance to see, which you never will, you know, no video footage of any of his games, I don't think. And then we strayed out, I went to see Brendan Ormsby, who hasn't been well for a long time. Brendan wasn't well when I went to see him. His powers of speech are really not there, although he has that amazing Ormsby twinkle in his eye, which makes you realise that he's got some stories to tell from through his career. But it's got a really, really rich heritage, Leeds, as you'd expect over 100 years, but very, very deep, I think. And you can see why people become so attached to the club.
I do wonder, out of all the players who've played for Leeds United in their history, how many have gone on to become pub landlords? Because obviously yeah. Peter Lorimer did. It was one of those things you did from back then.
Or a sports shop. Yeah. They were basically your options as a retired footballer. And a few did insurance sales as well, I think, didn't they, in the sort of 70s, 80s. That was another route.
Yeah, because none of them, give or take, earned enough money to just retire, you know, just to head off and basically be comfortable for the rest of their lives. It's not as if they didn't earn anything. It's not as if they didn't earn well for the time, but the wages weren't as extreme as they are now. I mean, you've reached the level now where there are players who earn more in a single week, okay, pre-tax, than some people play on in their entire lifetime, and a fair few of them as well. And it wasn't like that back then. So, you know, you did have people like Peter, who, one of the best players of his generation, best goal scorers of his generation, who did not have much towards the end. You know, you had other people like Eddie, obviously, who subsequently managed and then coached during the O'Leary era. But none of these guys are in any way flash or, and they're all incredibly approachable as well. I find that from that era. And I always thought that was one of the best and most likeable things about the Reavie squad, was that with most of them, it wasn't, I'm sure to people who support the club, and I didn't when I was young, but I'm sure to people who support the club, you know, it's, there's the, that kind of, godlike syndrome when you're standing talking to them, but they don't really make you feel like that, and you don't feel as if you're having to, if you want to interview them or anything else, you never feel as if you're having to jump over hurdles, jump through hoops in order to do it. There was a book published about 4 or 5 years ago and I did a chapter for it with Mick Jones and I phoned Mick up and said I'd just like to come down and, you know, meet you to chat to you, and he said, yeah, just come to my house tomorrow. So I did, you know, and it was fine. Sat there, spoke to him. His wife was there, chipped in with a few stories. Absolutely lovely. And he's got some great stories.
I think I've likened it in the past too. Have you ever seen the book or the film, The Right Stuff, which is about the astronauts, the early astronauts, the test pilots, the proper, you know, getting strapped to a rocket and fired up, off into the upper atmosphere type stuff. And it took an incredible amount of character and fibre to basically, or minerals, just to put yourself up there thinking, I'm just going to get shot into the atmosphere. I might not come back. And those that stripe of astronaut, of test pilot, was called the right stuff. And that's what I always likened that team to. Like, there is that kind of down-to-earth quality to them, but also that star quality as well, that real magnetism.
I think as well, one of the things that interests me about football clubs is the way in which, as time goes on, even the difficult periods, really difficult periods, you can become quite affectionate about further down the line. You know, at the point where it all becomes benign, so you don't feel angry about it anymore because it's so long ago and there's no point. I mean, I know that some of the Revy players are still, those that have left us, some of them were very, very angry about 1975 and the final, but you'll speak to some others who say, look, it was so long ago now. You know, what is the point, you know, keeping yourself awake at night?
I mean, you say that, but then again, I'm still angry about Gordon Watson's dive in the 6-1 Leeds United at Hillsborough in the championship winning season of 91-92.
Yeah.
If I met him in a pub, I'd have a go about it.
Yeah, there are certain respects in which I love being petty about football, you know, like that. I don't think you could, to be fair to the Revy squad, I don't think you could call it petty. I mean, that was I always remember, you know, Peter Lorimer saying to me, it was supposed to be the biggest night of our careers. And in the end, it was just the disappointment of our lives. And that's how it was. It never came around again. That was that. And you know, the squad had started to break up by that point, but it kind of hastened afterwards. I mean, Alan Clark said to me quite openly, you know, I struggle to shake Beckenbauer's hand now, struggle to be civil with him in the street because of what went on in that game. I think there are others who feel totally different. But that's what makes you tapestry as a football club, isn't it? You know, even like the Chileno and GFH years,
the banter years.
GFH were like the village idiots, weren't they? And Chileno was just Chileno. And I guess when you look back, and particularly it helps when you've had intervening years which have been incredible in the way that some of the last four or five were. I don't know whether affectionate is the right word, but you can be a bit more philosophical about it all, and I guess you can laugh a little bit more as well. It's no club rides at the top forever.
Talking about footballers' earnings there, I've just done some back of the fag packet calculations. You see the reports of Erling Haaland earning £900,000 a week at Man City.
Is that all?
Apparently, well, he's on the same sort of, he's on minimum wage, yeah. But he's on the same, you know, limits as the rest of the squad. Like, he hasn't gone outside the wage structure. But with all the bonuses totted up, he's on £900,000. I mean, I don't know if it's true. It was just a report that made it into the press. But you break it down. Do you know how much he earns? He earns £90 a second. A second, if that's true.
My first job was at the Leadburn Inn, which sadly burned down. True story. And I was paid £2 an hour to wash dishes. This was 1996, I think.
And do you look back on that one fondly now?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, the rich, rich tapestry.
Now you're on £90 an hour at the Athletic. It's easy to laugh at it.
I was saying when...
No denial.
I was saying when Haaland was pictured on the City's Twitter feed signing his contract, I was saying to somebody in our office, it must be, essentially the contract must be like when you start any job, you know, you get given a contract, you've got to sign in the right places, it's all got to be done legally. And everybody's contract says you will be paid, if it's an annual salary, you will be paid per annum X, you know, so £20,000, £30,000, whatever it is. His must have said something like, you'll be paid per annum £40 million. You just think, what, at his age, what are you going to do with it? You know, where's it?
Alfie Haaland there looking over his shoulder, just rubbing his hands.
And there has to be a point where you go in and you turn down the one that says £30 million, because you've got to get more than that.
I also think, like, you know, if you just had a current account at, say, NatWest or RBS or something, and suddenly, you know, £40 million a year, going into it, would they say, can't really accommodate this?
No, they do, don't they, though? Have you ever seen, like, very occasionally you've seen, like, screen grabs or somebody's photographed, like, a, you know, one of the information slips you could get from the cash point, or maybe even photograph the cash point itself? I think they do.
Yeah.
I mean, sensible, you'd invest it somewhere, wouldn't you?
Well, if the square ball ever escalates to that level, let me know.
We'll be sure to be on the phone. Sorry, Athletic.
I'll never hear from you again. No.
Going back to that centenary thing, I actually missed the centenary game because my wedding anniversary is around this week in the calendar, because I went for the international international weekend to get married, which I thought was good forward planning. What do you remember of that game?
It was a good narrative because it was Phillips with the goal, and it was actually quite trademark Leeds and Bielsa in that they dominated and they dominated. And as Bielsa used to talk about a lot, we have a lot of chances, but we don't take enough of them. The efficiency thing. But in the end, it was Phillips who was there. And it was just it was a cracking day in what was shaping up to be a cracking season. And I think it's a good thing that the centenary fell when it did. I mean, I get that.
What,
it was
100 years on from when
I get that it was always going to fall 100 years after the club's inception. But what I mean is,
had it, every time that, doesn't it?
I suppose to put that the other way around, it's a good thing that the Bielsa era coincided with the centenary as opposed to some of the other seasons that could have fallen on that date.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, like, I've never quite forgiven the club for the kit they came up with. It wasn't bad, it just didn't have any particular historical relevance. I mean, like, the, you know, the laces around the neck is not something that means anything. So I could never quite forgive them for that. And the fact that they only put out like a limited edition number of them, I think they could have sold tens of thousands of that. Loads of people would have bought it. However, whatever criticisms you want to direct at them, could you imagine, like you say, if GFH had been in charge of this particular thing, or even...
Yeah, if the centenary game had 17,000 people at it, who were all kind of miffed.
Absolutely. If it had been Leeds 1, Bolton 5 or something like that, you know, it would just not have been what anybody was looking for.
I mean, Bielsa was describing the Phillips goal when he said sometimes God puts things in the right place, didn't he? But I think that can apply to Bielsa as well for that period, that he happened to be there for that game, and we were on the upward swing, weren't we, for a change.
Speaking of unlimited budgets and things like that then, so a final question just to close out this part. If you had endless amounts of money, what would you buy Leeds United for its birthday?
I would buy its million plus fans a mindfulness audiobook each.
Why? You're getting into your mindfulness at the minute.
Yeah, I keep waiting on about this, don't I? But it's actually been really good.
Are you becoming a monk, Phil, with all your kickboxing and your mindfulness?
My wife keeps saying to me, you're becoming very zen, you, which I don't think anybody's
got the monk's haircut.
Ever described him.
but you are dangerous, just to be clear as well.
Yeah, it's...
Do you think we're too highly strung as a fan base? Are we worse than others?
There's a very, very good reason. No, not worse than others, no. I think every single football fan base in the world is highly strung, with only a few exceptions. There's a reason for that, and that is because it can be a very stressful environment. Let's be honest, it's easy to sit now and think that and make yourself feel as if the Bielsa era seemed to go on for ages because it was so good. And it's easy now to sit and think that that is Leeds, you know, that's how it is. But I always remind myself that of the, you know, almost 20 years that I've been writing about them, quite a few were fairly forgettable and quite a few were unforgettable for pretty ridiculous reasons. So yeah. The ability to just breathe is good for everybody, I think.
Did you say there's no budget?
No budget.
All right, I'll have four left-backs and four strikers in that case.
That is actually a great idea. Yeah, just load up every single position and then we don't have to bother with transfer windows and we don't have to bother with discussions about where they're lighting.
And Pascal Strauch still starts because he's in form, he's doing all right. I think if it had to be a physical thing rather than footballers, a West Stand, a new West Stand, and a magician to make it built instantly, so we'd have more capacity.
Yeah. How much is that going to cost you?
No matter, does it? I've got a limitless budget.
True. Yeah. Like your square ball.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League One? FX is Welcome to Wrexham. Catch all new episodes Thursdays on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. Shopify.com/theathletic.
It's all been a bit of doom and gloom recently, Phil. So you're going to give me something to be positive about now. We're not bad going forward. Reasonable?
Statistically, yes.
Have you written about this, by the way? Has it been written about?
Yes, I certainly have. Yeah. Wrote about this on Wednesday with Mark Carey, one of our data guys. He said after the game, Marsh, on Sunday, we don't score enough goals. And just to flesh that out a little bit, I think what he meant was, and what he actually said was, in the periods of the games when we're on top, we don't score enough goals. And that was to a degree the story at Palace. You know, that chance for Bamford, the point of the game where Leeds were very dominant, could have, I think at 2-0, that would have asked a hell of a lot of Palace. So that could conceivably have killed the game. And he said again today, he was asked what he was happy with, and he thinks Leeds are defensively more sound. He thinks they've been competitive in games, which I think is fair comment. But he said goal scoring is something that we need to improve. So we went and we had a look at the data to see, sometimes with your eye, naked eye, you can sit and think, a lot of people said toothless after Palace. You know, I saw that word used a lot, and you can think not creating enough, not looking dangerous. And the stats kind of put them mid-table for things like shots on goal, shots on target, expected goals. Goal scored isn't especially high, but it's not horrific in the way that, you know, Wolves tally is with three
Wolves,
so far this
Wolves
season.
Wolves have scored three goals.
Wow. Can you imagine? You know, people talk to me a lot about, or from time to time, about the George Graham season. You know, the struggle for anything at home, or wins, spectacular wins. Three goals at this stage from Wolves is not a lot to chew on.
What did we score? That was the 96-97 season, wasn't it? The George Graham one. And we scored, was it 28 goals? I think something like that.
Something like that. I know in the Championship, Preston have still only scored eight.
Yeah.
And they're somehow eighth. Right. Eight from 14 games.
Well, Bournemouth, incredibly, are averaging fewer than seven shots on goal a game, you know, which is not very many. I mean, Manchester City, and I know they're not great to team to compare them with, but they're up at 18, you know, 18 shots a game. Bournemouth are down at, Bournemouth have a ridiculously low number of attempts that have even looked like leading to goals. And somehow they've got themselves up into double figures already. So it's not always an exact science, but I think what data people always feel, and what's quite often proven, is that the numbers tend to level out eventually. So if they show you as a side who don't create much, don't score much, that is likely to catch up with you at somewhere further down the line, even if you kind of buck the trend at one stage or other. What I think it tells you is that Leeds, when they're playing to their full potential, probably have what they need as an attacking force to be safe this season. I think what it doesn't give them is a huge amount of leeway to A, waste chances, to B, drop below what is the general highest standard, or C, I guess, to make little or not enough of the periods of the game where they are dominant, because I don't think they're a side who are going to run riot for 90 minutes too often. They're a side who are definitely going to have spells in games. And when they have spells in games, might well look really good, but they're going to have to punish those, and they're going to have to take advantage of them. And that will probably be the key to a steady run of results.
So just to flesh out the whole George Graham thing, this was the 96-97 season. We finished 11th that season, slap bang in the middle, 38-game season as well. We finished on 46 points, which wasn't bad, all things considered. We played 38, won 11. Drew 13, lost 14, scored 28 goals, but only conceded 38, which was one of the lowest in the division, and it was lower than both Man United, who won the league and conceded 44, and Newcastle, who finished second and conceded 40. So it weren't right bad.
No, there were certainly little runs in that season where there were two or three nil-nils in a row as well, and I think those ones really, really wear you down as a fan going to watch a third game in a row where there's not been a goal.
It was just before Christmas, Michael. We drew three on the bounce. Middlesbrough away, 0-0. Spurs at home, 0-0. Everton away, 0-0.
None of them actually bad results.
No.
Is the thing.
But
just dire to watch.
Well, that was followed by Coventry at home. We lost then. Man United away. We lost then. And then January the 1st, Newcastle away. We lost then. So we didn't win a game from the 30th of November to the 11th of January that season.
Do you remember that fan base in Italy who did that thing where they all came with massive arrows and ran either side of the goal pointing in the right direction? I mean, Leeds at the moment, their expected goals for this season is 11. They're bang on 11. And that's kind of around about 10th in the division. So numerically, they're not struggling, especially. But I think they haven't fired properly, have they, since the Chelsea game? And Marsh is aware of that. I think the tone of the press conference today, I think it made you aware that he's aware that there is a bit of chuntering out there and that they could do with getting a win on the board. That the results, you know, the last sort of five results haven't been great or haven't been as good as he would have liked. And I always think, even in short periods where it's not going as you want it to go, it is expedient for a head coach to acknowledge that, you know, and as opposed to just the whole thing of this is fine and everything's fine, to, you know, acknowledge the fact that, yeah, you do want to turn this on its head. And this is a really hard game on Sunday, but after that, it's Leicester away and Fulham at home. And I think those are games that Leeds have to be taking points from.
And it does crank the pressure up, though, the fact that we've kind of gone on this mediocre run, doesn't it? Just that little bit. Do you think that maybe that's where Marsh's defensiveness came from? Because what I thought, and just returning to the question that I started this show with, was you asked him a fairly benign, open question about, you know, the plans, the different plan A, plan B and all that. And he gave a long answer. It almost felt like he was, I don't know, trying to defend himself.
It made me think that he'd been thinking about it through the week and perhaps he'd been aware that people publicly were asking about that. You know, how easily can this team adapt? How much of a plan B do they have, if you want to use the phrase plan B? I mean, I agree with him that it's probably a simplistic way to put it, because you don't just shift from one scheme to another, do you? It can be kind of gradual. I just wonder, and you can maybe answer this, whether you think the scope for clubs to come under pressure and for a lot of clubs to potentially come under pressure is pretty massive this season. Looking at the field and looking at how tight it is, how many sides from eighth down do you think are even thinking about European football, a European qualification? How many of them are even remotely bothered about that? Taking out Liverpool in 10th, for example, who cannot finish 10th. That would just ask huge questions over there. But everybody else, how many of those sides are sitting saying, yeah, it'd be great to get into Europe? And how many are saying, quite happy staying up this season?
Well, I was going to say, do you know what that is, though? That's exactly because the reward of getting into either the Conference League or the Europa League feels so small in comparison to the jeopardy, of financial jeopardy, of going down. So unless you can
and
get
it means extra games.
Yeah, yeah. So unless you get into the Champions League, you almost feel there's almost like a pervading attitude of not sure we can bother with this. Now, I'm sure, like, you know, West Ham's run late into the Europa League, they loved it, absolutely loved it last season. I would kill to see Leeds in a European final. It'd be absolutely amazing to do that. But football as a whole doesn't really embrace the two lesser European competitions versus the wealth on offer in the Premier League.
I was just looking at the table with that in mind, actually. I think probably other than Man City, who would obviously be aiming to win it and probably will ultimately, Man United, who would probably want to be in the Champions League places, and Liverpool, who are way down, and obviously the bottom three, I think everyone else in the division would take what they are now, would just go, yeah, fine.
Yeah.
Just stop it now.
Aside from the bottom three.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, but the bottom three and then a few other teams, everyone else would go, yeah, fine, we're not down.
And I think that's probably why everyone's felt a little bit doom and gloom about all this, because there's a certain futility attached to being in the Premier League, and you can get swept up by it, can't you, when things are just a bit mediocre?
Yeah. I mean, looking at the bottom half of the table, you've got Leeds, no wins in five. You've got Palace, who were on defeat, draw, draw, defeat before the win at Selhurst Park. Villa, not in form. You've got Southampton, four defeats in a row. Wolves, three defeats in a row. Forest, draw, ended a run of defeats there. Leicester, one win in five. Looking at this BBC table, it might actually be longer than that, their run. There's quite a lot of streaks down there that could do with ending some point soon. This isn't an easy game for Leeds to end it in at home to Arsenal. No pretending that at all. But to go back to that comment from Marsh, him saying, you know, we do want to turn this around. You know, we do feel that it's been a long time since the Chelsea win. We do want to get on top of this. I think that's the right way to think about it. I think complacency is really, really dangerous in this division. Really dangerous, catches up with you really quickly. So while it's not as if, you know, five games does not constitute, I don't think, a massive or substantial loss of form. But I think it takes you into that, probably into that ballpark where that's what it can become if you don't manage to sort it out. And as I say, I'm not pretending that Arsenal this weekend is a point where the odds will say Leeds will sort it out, but it is Leicester away next weekend. It is, next Thursday. It is Fulham at home next weekend. Those are games you target, no?
You do, yeah. I mean, where can we hurt Arsenal? That's the question. I mean, and what needs to happen for us to get something out of that game? We were talking about the need almost for something to unbalance the game, a bit of a madness, weren't we, Michael? Let's say, like, you know, maybe an early penalty or a red card for Arsenal would really put the cat among the pigeons there.
I think so. They are a different team this season.
Or a Mendy-style mistake.
Yeah, absolutely. Which, to look at that game, the Chelsea game, in isolation, it was already starting to build on Chelsea slightly by that point. But that really put the question mark in their heads, Chelsea's heads, about, you know, the rest of the game was going to go. And the one thing that always happens in those circumstances is that Elland Road is incredibly good at getting on top of the opposition team. In a way that I just don't think opposition players enjoy. They're opposition players who love coming and dealing with that atmosphere when it goes well or when they cope with it. But it's not great when you're under the cosh and when it's all going against you. I can't see Arsenal doing anything other than coming and attacking. I cannot see them coming and trying to kill the first 25 minutes, half an hour, in the way that we saw Villa do and other teams this season. It just makes no sense. They're on such a roll at the moment. The signing of Jesus has been brilliant for them. I mean, I thought when they took him that seemed like, for the money, really, really good deal. And combined with that, it feels to me as if the players who Arteta and Arsenal have been saying for a while will come good are starting to come good quite spectacularly. And with Michael, I still think this will go City's way in the end. But they're a totally different team. And I just don't see, having beaten Liverpool last weekend, I don't see Arteta underestimating this fixture, but I just cannot see him saying, right, you know what, we're going to go to Elland Road and we're going to keep it tight. I just think he will say, back yourselves, because
in a perverse way, though, doesn't that give us more of a chance?
This is what I was going to say.
Their attacking intent leaves the opportunity and the space for us to go into it.
It does, and it will hopefully, if things go well, it will hopefully bring out little traits like Anderson's, you know, tendency to break through space over the halfway line through the centre circle when gaps open up. It will give, you know, people like Sinisterra and Harrison to attack the gaps as they are, assuming they open up out wide in behind Arsenal as well. That, I think, I don't think you'd want to suggest going toe-to-toe, because I think you have to employ a little bit of caution. But I would suggest that in order to get anything from this game or to win anything, or to win this game, Leeds will have to be absolutely ready and committed to going for gold when it opens up.
Yeah, and you know what you're not going to find, I mean, in very simple terms, you're not going to find Arsenal sitting there in two banks of four. Are you on the edge of their area? You're going to hopefully have a little bit of space to play in, because that's what seems to have stymied us a little bit this season, is that we try and play this narrow style through the middle and we just meet banks of players and can't get through them, and you end up seeing that horrible, ugly pinball stuff, and it forces players into doing stuff that maybe looks a little bit more industrial to try and break the deadlock. Whereas Arsenal, you get the sense that there might just be a little bit of space to play in and an opportunity for players like Aaronson, Sinisterra, and maybe just to get on the ball and do one or two bits.
Yeah, I think it's the unfortunate thing is that the teams, to judge by what's gone on so far, the teams who come to Elland Road and really have a pop are going to be the teams who are by far most difficult to beat. You know, Liverpool are not going to come here and be negative. Man City are not going to come here and be negative. Arsenal won't do, I don't think, at the weekend. So, it's hard, like you say, without a little bit of madness, it's hard to make a huge case for Leeds winning this. I think the odds will be heavily in Arsenal's favour, and they are definitely on a roll at the moment. But I still wonder whether they have it in them to throw in the odd off day, Arsenal. I don't think actually they had that much of an off day at Old Trafford when they lost to Manchester United. It was a kind of strange game that, which they were in, and I think, you know, we'll probably look back on and think they could actually have edged themselves if certain things had gone slightly differently. So, yeah, you might be right. A bit of madness would be great.
Just talk to me about Harrison then, because we mentioned him back in part one and his involvement in Leeds United's attacking play, and how crucial is he going to be on Sunday? Well, and I mean, is he an unsung hero for Leeds?
Well, I don't know about you, but it's felt to me all season as if the play was moving far more towards the left than it was towards the right. And the game that jumped out to me most was Brentford, where Harrison actually came off at half-time. And I think I tweeted at half-time to say, a huge amount has gone down his side of the pitch. You know, Brentford have been doubling up on him. not easy for him to do anything, but the ball is going to him time and time again. And Mark Carey, one of our data writers, he had a look at where Leeds United have created most of their chances from this season. So he mapped out a grid of the pitch, splitting it into kind of different areas outside the box, inside the box, on the wings and everything. And he found, unsurprisingly, that the highest number by far, 17%, had come both directly outside the D, so, you know, through balls into the box or whatever else from there, but also out on the left-hand side, wide left, which some will probably be corners, but also some will be Harrison's industry. And then when you start digging into Harrison's numbers, generally, most chances created, Harrison on 19, and you've got Anderson and Tyler Adams next on 10. Most big chances created is also Harrison with 4, two-headed Rodrigo and Strike. Most chances from dead balls, Harrison on 8. Most crosses from open play, Harrison on 23. Most dribbles, Harrison on 35. He is absolutely crucial to this. The way Leeds are playing is making him absolutely crucial to this. And there's a hell of a lot being asked of him. And it did seem to me that if you were looking for somewhere where Leeds could perhaps be a bit more, penetrate a bit more, be a bit more dangerous, then, you know, wide right where you have sometimes Aronson, but it does mix up, but, you know, Sinisterra as well, with Christensen in behind, that does look like a position where you could cut loose a bit more.
Both of you then, who's your centre forward? Who's your starting centre forward on Sunday? Now you're mentioning Rodrigo being up front, it's kind of planted the idea in my head that maybe does Bamford drop to the bench, or is he for you like your nailed on starter?
I think Bamford starts again. I think
he does.
I think Marsh spoke today about he's not quite where we wanted him to be fitness-wise, but he's getting there. And I think the fact he's been given a day off today probably suggests that it's just go home and get yourself fresh for the weekend. I would be very surprised if he lasted the 90 minutes of the weekend. But I think if we're going to try and play him into some form and some fitness, he's got to play. And truthfully, these games are a little bit of a free hit where you don't actually expect to get any points. So in some ways, it's better for him to get fit in this than to be getting fit against Fulham in a game that I guess you would look at on paper and say we have to win.
It might be quite a revealing decision because he's not going to drop Aronson, is he? And you would assume that Sinisterra will come back in. I know he had the red card against Villa, which was a bit brainless, but he's played really well and looked really good, really tricky. I think you want him in the team. So if that is the case, it becomes a straight choice between Bamford and Rodrigo. As I say, when I was writing about the two of them and writing about the attacking stats, it did start to jump out how much more Rodrigo has contributed this season. I know he's played more, but even so, even if you boil it down per 90 minutes, which is sometimes the best way to figure this out, he has been more effective. But I know what we've seen over the last 2 years, and I also can't deny that looking at Bamford, I think his style suits this far better. But he needs to be fully fit and he needs to be absolutely on it, and that has been a challenge so far.
Well, fingers crossed Arsenal have an off day, and fingers crossed that Leeds United have an on day. Birthday on the mind. You don't want to ruin your birthday, do you, the day after by losing on Sunday?
The way Arsenal's front three written on the notes from the press, which says it's a sentence, actually. It says Martinelli, Saka, Jesus.
Yeah, well, we'll see that if that's applicable when we come back together on Monday, you and I, Phil, and we'll debrief the Arsenal game. And we'll speak to you then.
The Phil Hay Show.